Advent is a time to reflect, pray, and worship the Christ who came, who comes, and will come again. The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for December is an Advent devotional booklet called The Jesse Tree. These short daily devotions are filled with symbols, telling the story of Jesus from creation to his second coming. The Jesse Tree is available for only $3. Learn more at issuesetc.org or by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The Jesse Tree. When I started doing this program 22 years ago, the subject of postmodernism was very hot. We spent a lot of time exploring what postmodernism was, and in particular, its moral relativism, or its belief that there is no truth, or if there is truth, we can't really know it. So everyone needs to adopt a relative position. My truth is my truth, and yours is yours, and what's right for you may not be right for me, or wrong for you may not be wrong for me. That's a very familiar subject, but nowadays, somehow, that has moved from that relative position to a very dogmatic position. You will not find many people, especially in progressive social justice movements, saying, well, my truth is my truth and your truth is your truth. No, my truth should be your truth. They're very dogmatic. What has changed? And we know that this movement, this progressive social justice movement, knows what it doesn't want. We've seen that for the last 8 months. Does it know what it does want? Welcome back to Issues, Etc. We're going to be talking about the relativism and the dogmatism of the progressive social justice movement. Joining us to do so, Dr. R.J. Snell. He's contributing editor for public discourse and director of academic programs at the Witherspoon Institute. Previously served as professor of philosophy and director of the philosophy program at Eastern University and the Templeton Honors College. And he's author of a recent column for the public discourse titled Barbaric Dogmatists and the Revolution. Dr. Snell, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you so much, Todd. Delighted to be with you.
What has changed among college students since Alan Bloom wrote his famous book about the relativism of students in Closing of the American Mind?
Well, it's such a great and influential book. I remember reading it in the mid-90s when it had just been published for a few years, and thinking that it described the situation of myself and my peers and then eventually my own students somewhat perfectly. Bloom suggests in the book that relativism is the unquestioned assumption of the student, and that their great fear is not being wrong, not having an error, but being intolerant or viewed as intolerant. And so when I began teaching, there is a deep sense of students being committed to relativism, sometimes to absurd levels. You know, a student would say that they were personally opposed to fill in the blank of some grave moral crime, but who were they to say that was the case for other people? Recently, upon rereading Bloom, it seems to me that it no longer describes the student experience nearly as accurately. Now the great fear does not seem to be error or intolerance, but in fact not having the right opinions. It almost seems to be a complete reversal, where now students have dogmatic assumptions about the nature of justice and the nature of politics. And while they may be relativists in the theoretical sense, by which I mean they might not have a complete grounding or an account of their position, they may not think there's a metaphysical principle or a rational principle or God to ground their beliefs, those beliefs are very firmly held, and to not hold those same beliefs dogmatically is to somehow be outside the pale of decent conversation. And that's a significant change.
What of the previous relativism has survived? It sounds like they have kind of chosen a quasi-relativism for themselves while becoming, as you say, dogmatic.
Well, there certainly is a sense of tolerance for others and a refusal to question the moral life choices of others. That seems to have continued from the old relativism. I'm thinking here of sort of sexual moralities and kind of lifestyle liberalism, where you live and let live in terms of personal choice. But what seems to have changed considerably is the idea that politics and demands of justice are open for interpretation or are relative from community to community, person to person, time to time. Now, in fact, there seems to be quite dogmatic positions taken. It is wrong, it is beyond the pale to object to the lifestyle liberalism of others. It is wrong, it is beyond the pale of ordinary society to be a traditionalist about marriage or that sort of thing.
Does this dogmatism have other religious qualities as well?
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating question. Christianity and Judaism in so many ways are trans-worldly religions. They look beyond the world, beyond the universe, for a source of salvation and a source of creation and hope. The current moment of dogmatism I would describe as an inner-worldly religion. It places its hope in politics and in human action. And interestingly, because it places its hope in inner-worldly states of affairs, in the old phrase that used to bat around from the 60s and 70s, they immanentize the eschaton, they try to make heaven on earth just now. It also seems to have the religious quality of something like original sin, to have the wrong position on marriage, maybe even sometimes to be the wrong race or the wrong gender about certain conversations, is to be tainted. But what's different is that while there's sinfulness, there doesn't seem to be forgiveness or even a sense of redemption, other than the kind of Gnostic redemption of getting your ideas and your commitments and your actions in the right place. So it seems very religious in having kept a sense of sin, but a sin without hope of real forgiveness. You can see that, for instance, in things like cancel culture or no platforming, where people are not allowed to speak or not allowed to voice their opinions because there's no forgiveness for them. They are tainted beyond redemption.
The roots of this really go back, as you say, to the late 60s and the early anti-fascist movements. Tell us about that.
Well, of course, whenever you point to history, someone will always have a counterexample and say, well, no, it really went back farther or something like that. Certainly, though, we see certain elements of the 60s which are being repeated now. In my essay from Public Discourse, I dwell a lot in the work of Augusto Del Noce in his book, The Age of Secularization. He argues that the anti-fascist movements of the 40s through the 60s had two elements. One was a kind of nationalism. You could think of that as a nation first or pointing to a particular place in time or a community. And then what he calls anarchism. And he says what is lost from the 60s on is the nationalism part, but what is kept is the anarchism. Anarchism here meaning not just a sense of rioting in the streets or that sort of thing. Anarchism here meaning a rejection of the old moral norms, of the logos, of law. And with the rejection of the old moral norms, a sense that justice is not grounded in anything particular so much as it is willed and demanded. So you have anti-fascists actually recapitulating or living out fascistic tendencies, namely anarchism, but without the nationalism to go with it.
Why did those anti-fascists of the late 60s have a problem in the end defining either justice or injustice?
Del Noce's diagnosis of this, which I think is both fascinating and very unique, I haven't heard others make this argument, but I think right, is that in their anarchism, they believed that there was a taint or an unovercomable guilt to the old moral systems, to Christianity, to Judaism, even to more secular positions like Kantianism. The old alternatives that had been alive in the West were all rejected. Now, each of those accounts, maybe not the same, Christianity, Kantianism, Judaism, and so on, they all have an account of justice and injustice, an account of righteousness, of what is good, of what is evil. The anarchists, in rejecting all of the old accounts as being no longer useful or even worse, guilty beyond redemption, still wanted to have justice and they still wanted to overcome and refute injustice, but they no longer had grounds for doing so because they had rejected all of the moral alternatives. As a result, the only thing that was left for them were not accounts of divine command or of righteousness or of human flourishing or natural law, moral law. None of the old theories were alive anymore. And what replaced the old moral theories was instead an account of repression and liberation. Anything which repressed human satisfaction, particularly in the sexual domain, that was unjust. And anything which liberated, particularly that anything which removed guilt or shame that was associated with repression, that was now just.
Dr. R.J. Snell is our guest. We're talking about the relativism and the dogmatism of the progressive social justice movement. So how does that framework of repression and liberation, how does it connect to the moral views of today's college students? Listen to the best of the church's music for the Advent season at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the Advent season, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Remember when education was about the fundamental skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic? And about reading great literature and studying history to give our kids a model for what it is to be a good person? Memoria Press's classical Christian curriculum offers that very model for your homeschool. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR21. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues Etc.
It's almost that special time to unpack your Advent and Christmas ornaments. But there's a problem. Your ornaments are from the 80s. They're made of styrofoam, the glitter has dropped off, and they are being held together with toothpicks. Don't celebrate another Christmas hearkening back to the age of glitter balls. Ad Crucem's ornaments are beautifully designed and lovingly made. Right here in Colorado, we offer all the old designs and a whole lot of new ones. Visit adcrucem.com. That's ADCRUCEM.com.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's Life Ministry is thousands of people sharing Christ's love and mercy and giving witness to our Lord's creation of life, His design for marriage and the family, and the God-given value of all human life from conception to natural death. Working with many partners, LCMS Life Ministry sponsors human care efforts that meet the needs of body and soul and provides resources and educational events for all ages. To learn more, email lifeministry@lcms.org and visit lcms.org/life.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Wednesday, December the 2nd, we're talking about the relativism and dogmatism of the progressive social justice movement. Dr. R.J. Snell, Director of Academic Programs at the Witherspoon Institute, is our guest. So before the break, you were talking about this framework of repression and liberation that has taken the place of natural law, any kind of objective moral framework with the revolutionaries. How does that connect to the moral views of the revolutionaries among our college students today?
If one looks at the old Berkeley professors of the 60s, I'm thinking here in particular of Herbert Marcuse. People should read, if they want to understand the current moment, they really should read Herbert Marcuse and the Italian theorist Gramsci, and you'll understand that much of the current moment in a minute. Marcuse argued in his essay on liberation that anything which repressed was unjust. Anything which liberated was essentially just. If we look at the current college student, particularly their dogmatism about sexual matters, you see something very similar. All of the older accounts, traditional accounts of marriage, Christian understandings of chastity and fidelity and monogamy, just to take that as an example, are viewed as repressive, thus unjust, thus needing to be deconstructed and taken apart, and instead a dogmatic insistence on liberation. So we see in the current college students something of a recapitulation or repetition of that anarchism which rejects all that is old as being defunct and instead having only repression and liberation as their account of justice. But of course, if anything represses, it is per se unjust. And so Marcuse argues that you must in fact be intolerant of anything which represses, and you must tolerate only that which liberates. That's a dogmatism in favor of liberation. And while it's a kind of relativism in the overarching sense of not having a grounding. It's a dogmatism, overt dogmatism, with an orthodoxy about what's acceptable and unacceptable in polite society and right-thinking people and the right side of history, to think of some of the language that we hear.
So how should we understand the apparent inability of today's revolutionaries to make moral distinctions between, for instance, American figures of history who supported slavery and American figures of history who opposed slavery?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I'm thinking here just as a concrete example of the tearing down of monuments that we've seen over the last few years, but it's received much attention in 2020, where we have not only monuments to Confederate soldiers and generals being torn down, but somewhat incongruously, statues of people like Frederick Douglass or Abraham Lincoln being torn down. And, you know, Lincoln was complicated about race in many ways, but he certainly was not a proponent of slavery. And so to tear down a Confederate monument at the same time as you're tearing down a monument to Lincoln seems very strange, because the Confederate monument and the monument to Lincoln seem to be giving diametrically opposed moral views, one in favor of slavery or Jim Crow, the other quite against, and in favor of things like the Declaration and equal protection of the law. The inability to make the distinction between those two is that they are lumped together, all of them, as symbols of repression, as symbols of the old world, which had thick moral accounts of justice, thick moral obligations and accounts of duty. And all of those old accounts of duties are thought to be repressed, and we must be liberated from them all. And so the needed distinctions between historical figures are all sort of washed away, and they're lumped together as simply guilty as charged, not meeting the new moral demands of the time.
Then talk about what you call a blessed rage for destruction at this particular moment in American history. What do you mean by that?
I'm playing off a title by a theologian named David Tracy, who wrote a book called The Blessed Rage for Order. We don't seem to have necessarily a blessed rage for order at the moment, if by order we mean things like the moral law or natural law. We seem to instead be in a fit or a peak of destruction. We've seen this in universities for decades now. Not only the taking down of the old canon of what we read, the Bible, the classics, etc., but increasingly a rage to disassemble not just monuments, but to disassemble old moral structures, like traditional marriage, for instance. In many ways, and I'm uncertain if I'm right about this, but I think I'm right, and I'm speculating here. For some that we've seen in the streets rioting in 2020, destruction seems to be thought of almost as salvific, or something akin to salvation. Even violence seems to bring a kind of redemption, or ersatz, alternative fake redemption, to their minds. Why this urgency, this delight in destruction? Well, it seems that if one believes that the old systems are repressive, somehow interfering with liberation, if we can destroy them in a kind of rage, that destruction is thought of as bringing about a kind of beatitude or blessedness or salvation. Here it's the salvation of liberation, a liberation which knows no end. It's not clear what would satisfy its conditions. It's not clear when or why it would stop, because liberation breeds more liberation, and the old repressions give way to new ideas which are thought to be repressive. Even think, for instance, property is now viewed of as repressive. There was a book came out this year called In Defense of Looting. Even the idea of private property is now repressive. It's not clear where this blessed rage will end in the demand for more and more undifferentiated, undefined liberation.
Dr. R.J. Snell is our guest. He's director of academic programs at the Witherspoon Institute. We'll continue our conversation with him on the other side of the break. I'm wondering, given what he just said, does the social justice movement know what it wants? We certainly know what it doesn't want, but does it know what it wants? After that, Lauren Fink will join us to talk about the dangers of school closings. Then Cardinal Raymond Burke will be alongside. We'll talk with him about Pope Francis's reported comments about same-sex civil unions.
Solid, serious, substantive. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the relativism and dogmatism of the progressive social justice movement. Dr. R.J. Snell is our guest, contributing editor of Public Discourse and director of academic programs at the Witherspoon Institute. Previously served as a professor of philosophy and director of the philosophy program at Eastern University and the Templeton Honors College. And he's author of a recent column for the Public Discourse titled Barbaric Dogmatists and the Revolution. Dr. Snell, given what you said before the break, that this notion of everything old must go, and by the time we've gotten rid of all of it, the new stuff is old too, it's very clear that the social justice movement knows what it doesn't want. Does the movement know what it does want?
I'm unwilling to just lump everyone into the same camp. I myself don't particularly like the phrase social justice warriors, because there are certainly men and women of good conscience and good faith who have identified real injustice in our society. I know there is injustice in our society of various sorts, and some quite wicked, and some needing to be overcome, and some needing to be repented. And many who advocate for social justice know what they want. They want the kingdom of God, or they want the blessed community, or they want just basic decency and rule of law. They want what they take to be economic or racial justice. And I don't mean to demean that. One can disagree prudentially with a particular policy without calling into question the motivations and aims of the other. But there are others who might be lumped into the category of social justice warriors who I do not believe have any positive definition in mind. I think that they have only a negation in their aims. They wish to destroy, to deconstruct, to take apart, to unmask. They wish to show that the emperor has no clothes, but they have no clothes and no emperor to bring back to rule or to guide their aims. They want liberation. They wish to be free from all and any constraint which they believe to be repressive. Think, for instance, of the transgender movement, where even one's own body is viewed as repressive. One's own genetic code is viewed as repressive, something to be overcome and undone and manipulated. Well, what is the end to that other than an open liberation which has no definition, which has no aim, which has no end? It's merely against whatever is thought to be repressive at the moment.
Why do you quote Plato with respect to the current revolutionaries, calling them drones with stings?
Yeah, thank you for that question. Well, I love Plato's Republic. It's one of my favorite books. Maybe two-thirds of the way through Plato's Republic, Plato gives an account of the devolution or the falling apart of regimes and political systems, where you move from a decent regime to one which is slightly not as good, and in the end, it devolves to utter tyranny. At one point in the story, Plato distinguishes what he calls drones and drones with stings. Drones, as in Plato's description, are those, in his account, it's sons, but the children of those who have money. And those who have money often have it because they've been careful and prudent, not given to luxury. And the drones, their children, have not done the work, have not done the labor, and they merely want the pleasures. But then the money runs out, Plato says, and these same children who have been used to luxury, used to pleasure, used to freedom, used to, in my account here, the blessed rage for destruction, are unable to attain what they had become accustomed to. And so they become not just drones, not worker bees, but they become wasps. They become bees with stingers, ones which harm and attempt to harm. The current revolutionaries, in my account here, referencing Plato, are not just simply those who wish to enjoy the freedoms of America. They're not simply the children of the 80s who liked capitalism and liked the market, those sorts of things. They are now those who have weapons either in hand or weapons in classroom of argument and destruction, who wish to take apart and are increasingly willing to not only use overt violence, we've seen this in the streets, in looting, protests, destruction, but are willing to use enforced behavior codes in the schools and universities, who are willing to fire, who are willing to not hire, who are willing to impair the religious freedom of others. Those are the drones with stings.
Dr. R.J. Snell is a contributing editor of Public Discourse and director of academic programs at the Witherspoon Institute. He previously served as professor of philosophy and director of the philosophy program at Eastern University and the Templeton Honors College. And he's author of a recent column for the Public Discourse titled Barbaric Dogmatists and the Revolution. You can read it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk On Demand Archives. Dr. Snell, thank you very much.
Wonderful to be with you. Thank you, Todd.
We'll discuss the dangers of school closings with Lauren Fink, author of a column for National Review Online titled The COVID Kids, after this.
Do you want your neighbors and community to see what you're celebrating this Christmas season? Why not display an outdoor nativity in front of your home or church? It's a great way to show others what Christmas is all about, the birth of our Savior, Jesus Christ. Check out the Outdoor Nativity Store at OutdoorNativityStore.com. Durable, affordable, and American-made nativities, OutdoorNativityStore.com, OutdoorNativityStore.com.
Did you know that many LCMS military personnel and their families are unable to receive Word and Sacrament ministry due to the lack of LCMS chaplains? Ministry to the Armed Forces is looking for pastors who will answer the call to serve as a chaplain to provide Word and Sacrament ministry to the men and women who selflessly serve our nation. Find out more about this exciting ministry by contacting me, Chaplain Craig Mueller, at lcmschaps@lcms.org. That is lcmschaps@lcms.org.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Advent is a time to reflect, pray, and worship the Christ who came, who comes, and will come again. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for December is an Advent devotional booklet called The Jesse Tree. These short daily devotions are filled with symbols telling the story of Jesus from creation to his second coming. The Jesse Tree is available for only $3. Learn more at issuesetc.org or by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The Jesse Tree.
Did you know that Lutherans are helping new American immigrants get settled? How about struggling church workers in need of support and refreshment? And we assist at-risk children and provide disaster response to hurricane victims. Through LCMS recognized service organizations, we are doing all this and more. I'm Rahema Kavuga of Lutheran Church Extension Fund, and I don't want you to miss out on hearing what your brothers and sisters in Christ are up to. Visit interesttime.org to see how your support gives life to these works of mercy and love.